Hi everyone, and welcome to the EdTech Podcast. This week we've got a fantastic guest episode courtesy of listener David Booth. David is a former founder, product manager, and early stage technology investor with a background in venture capital and law. One of his current projects is working with Beyond Deck, a series of dinners happening all around the world to bring together change makers in various sectors. This recording is from one of those very dinners held in London with special guest Alex Beard. You may remember Alex Beard from episode 125 with Kenny Nichols from Canvas, who referenced Alex's book Natural Born Leaders as one of his top reads. So it is timely to welcome Alex onto the podcast to discuss the ideas penned in his book. Former podcast guest Jeff Barton described the book as an educational book that's audacious, sassy, and unafraid of the big questions in his review for the Times Educational Supplement. Indeed, this episode ranges from Silicon Valley to South Korea to Singapore, Finland, Southwark, and Socrates. Have a listen and do share your comments back via the voicemail function on the website or Twitter or Facebook. Sitting back from the interviewer role in this episode, my only own additional questions to Alex would be to dig into the risks of working with big tech and learning, as we are only starting to understand child psychology in relation to technology designed to aid our decision making. Finally, it is interesting that whilst Beard acknowledges that many schools are doing great on doing or being, how do we pull all the facets of the new natural born leaders, teachers of the 21st century, together? But before all that, a few announcements. First up, congrats to listener Chris Kwewakoe, CEO of SlateCube in Nigeria, for winning tickets to EduTech Africa via the EdTech Podcast this week. Looking forward to your report back on the show, Chris, and sharing that with our listeners. Next, as part of my role as a mentor for the Catapult Accelerator in Norway, I've been speaking this week with lab simulation company PraxiLab, who are looking for feedback on what they're developing. Go and check out praxilabs.com and see how you might be able to work with them. Finally, there are all sorts of awards flying around. If you haven't already entered, check out the BET Awards. Then outside of that, over in Florida, the EdTech Digest EdTech Awards are open. Lots of categories for both ed and tech to get involved. Right, that's all for now. Enjoy this episode with Alex Beard, former English teacher turned author, and have a great week.
So this is something new that we're going to try for one of these events. The main thing is that I just wanted to make sure we had Alex sort of framed right, set up right, to sort of tell us a little bit about what he's learned. Anyone that hasn't read the book, I'm not here to sell it, but I read it and I enjoyed it. It takes you through a journey of technology and applications in schools around the world. There was also a thesis raised, which I mainly agree with, but I'm keen to challenge. Alex, do you want to take us away? Tell us a little bit about how you got to where you are today, why you decided to write a book, and maybe we'll finish with why you're building a university in Wales. We can close on that one.
Thank you. On that bombshell. This is my first fireside chat, and I'm very excited to be doing it. It started for me 10 years ago. I became a teacher, so I'm an English teacher in a secondary school in Elephant Castle in South London. And, you know, at first I really struggled as a teacher. At the time I was just straight out of university, kind of fresh-faced. I'd been to a really nice primary school in the countryside. I had gone on to a secondary school, a ridiculous secondary school that even had its own pack of beagles. And I thought that teaching was just about standing at the front of the classroom and sort of talking about ideas, and that's how it happened, like Robin Williams in Dead Poets Society. But it wasn't the movies, it was very far from it. These were kids, half of them were on free school meals, two-thirds spoke English as a second language. All of them came from these two big estates in Elephant and Castle with the Haygate and the Aylesbury that have mostly been knocked down now. But at the time, sort of, you know, crime ridden, like clearing house for new immigrants to the country. And all of them were far behind where they should have been in their reading and writing. Through no fault of their own, the kids were really smart and they're very witty. They used to, you know, cuss me very imaginatively all the time. I had this pair of shoes with a sole came off, and they called them my walkie-talkies. And there's another boy who, like, every morning I wouldn't have an iron shirt. I'd do, I fight with the irons. And so they were witty, they were fun, and they were beginning to sort of live in the future. They had smartphones, and like they were endlessly gaming like all night long. And their methods I was using as a teacher were like, I felt they would have been familiar to Socrates, maybe. They were super old-fashioned. And yet, as I was kind of looking around me, reading things, looking at things, I was seeing all these advances we were making in sort of our understanding of the human mind in neuroscience and psychology and early child development. And I was seeing all these advances in technology, whether it was, you know, VR or AI or like internet giving access to knowledge all over the place, uses of data, and thought that, you know, perhaps if we could harness this new knowledge and these new tools, we could transform learning and bring it up to date for the 21st century. I thought we could definitely do better than an interactive whiteboard and a teacher who was making it up as he went along. And so I set off on this journey around the world. It took about 3 years on and off. I went to schools and institutions and universities on 6 continents. I spoke to trailblazing educators and teachers. I met with neuroscientists and tech experts. And I sort of came to the end of that all with this idea for the book and these ideas about what the future of learning might look like. And the book tells the story of that journey and those meetings. That's how it all came about.
That's a good start. One of the key things when you do sort of explore metaphors of the way the mind learns with computation, and though perhaps that's sort of an insufficient metaphor, it's actually quite damaging to the process that the brain is not a machine that gets programmed by schools. And a lot of, I mean, my knee-jerk reaction when I think about technology in schools is automate the hell out of it, get like algorithms that generate the next question that you should ultimately be asked. Whereas I think there's a sort of conclusion that was perhaps at the other end of the spectrum to that.
Yeah, so I would say, first of all, about how our brains learn. Like the meeting that really hit home for me was with this guy, Deb Roy. And Deb Roy, who some of you guys are probably aware of, was a computer scientist at the MIT Media Lab, like big in robotics, like one of like the world's leading kind of roboticists. And he was married, or he's married to a speech and language expert at another university, so like two serious academics. And he basically made this bet with his wife that he had built a robot that could learn language the way people learn language. And she was like, I don't think that you have. Like, you probably haven't done that. And so he tried to prove it, and like through various different means. And he had this sort of toucan-type robot with a little quiff and like, you know, ping pong ball eyes. And the thing that he couldn't get was the recorded speech that you would need to give the robot to hear, so that it would learn in a way that a kid learns. Like, you know, a kid learns by hearing speech endlessly throughout his childhood from parents and others. And so he set this mad experiment where he decided that he was going to film the entire first 5 years of his own son's life. So he rigged up his whole Boston home with these ceiling cameras, microphones, every room had them. And he just recorded these 5 years so that he could generate all of this video and audio footage that he could then feed to his computer afterwards. And anyway, so whilst doing this whole thing, and like having, it was his first child and he had his son, he just came to this realization that the way that a human being learns language is far more complicated than he had ever really paid attention to. And he has this moment of realization where he's sitting with his son, and his son sees this fish on the wall, and he says his first word, and there's this moment of understanding that passes between them. And I think his fundamental insight is that learning is incredibly complex. It's like three-dimensional, and it's sort of infinite. Like you're continually learning at every moment. Your brain is changing in reaction to any input. Like right now, all of our brains are changing based on this in small ways, whereas like the algorithms that he'd be programming to his language learning robot had been very much top down based on rules that he'd input into it. So I think first of all, like, our brains are very much capable of learning in a computational way and working a bit like computers, but that's not the only thing that they can do. They can also emote and feel and connect to other people, and we haven't really explained sort of how those things work, which then brings me on to how our schools might be set up. Like, I do think that.
And while you're doing so, I mean, is there anyone that's doing this well? Examples of, say, technology companies selling into schools, or schools that are building from the ground up to take kind of an algorithmic-driven approach to either content generation or control of the classroom or
Definitely. Person. So I went to a school, a chain of schools in Silicon Valley in San Jose called Rocketship Schools. And they sort of about 10 years ago, like, got on this idea that they could, they had lots of very exciting headlines about how they were going to actually revolutionise schools across America, and soon every kid would be in a rocket ship school. And their big thing was like a very seasoned educator, this guy who'd been a head teacher for ages, and this tech entrepreneur sort of set it up together. And they didn't quite revolutionise all schools across America, but they are doing amazing things in the classrooms. They have something there called the Learning Lab. And the Learning Lab, I went to visit it. By the way, rocket ship schools also have all these other weird things that they do. So in the morning before I went to the Learning Lab, the head teacher, Miss Guerrero, led the whole school in a sing-along to Shake It Off by Taylor Swift. And like, all these five-year-olds were like going crazy.
What are you doing after this?
I'm going to do that. We're all going to do that together. They called it morning coffee for the kids. Anyway, so in this Learning Lab, there were like 120 five- and six-year-old kids, that each of them like, in headphones in front of laptops, wearing these purple polo shirts, these rocketeers, they call them. And they were each using these programs. One was called ST Math, one was called Lexile. And the school had helped to develop those programs with startups from sort of day one. So bringing in like the education stuff. And the kids would spend, they're really young kids, an hour to 90 minutes in this Learning Lab every single day. There were no teachers in the room, just like a couple of untrained supervisors. And it really worked. So this was adaptive software, so it's understanding the kids' strengths and weaknesses, responding to them, sort of giving them their own personalised learning path, and then also, you know, churning out that data so teachers could use it to know where they needed to intervene in certain topics within the classroom. They could work in small groups, and that does amazing stuff. That outsources part of teaching, it automates part of teaching. Like that part of teaching, when you're a kid and you're practicing sums and your math teacher sitting there reading the paper, you don't need to have a teacher there. Like, you know, that can be taken care of, that can be automated. I think then the assessment of what those kids are doing, that can easily be automated. I don't think teachers need to do that stuff anymore.
I think obviously vary across the spectrum of, say, like, have they solved their times tables correctly versus have they written a good essay about Shakespeare?
Absolutely.
Sure.
No, it definitely does. But with those other ones where it's more like judgment based, I've seen some cool stuff like, you know, no more marking. So this is like a program where, you know, teachers are flashed up different essays and you just decide which one of the two essays is the best essay. And as you're reading along, you get a sense of like the general areas that students need to work on. And also you create a sort of rank order of which essays are best. So these things, these bits of tech that combine human judgment, outsource bits of teaching, bits of assessment. Yep. And you imagine they'll get better at doing things like judging essays, right?
Yeah.
I spoke to some tech companies in China where they're like 16 sentence paragraphs they think they can accept, you know, assess pretty accurately for quality and accuracy.
Tell me, there's a sort of a mental framework I quite like from the startup world called the full stack startup. There's a really good example of people had been building taxi dispatch software and selling it to taxi companies for a decade or more before Uber came along. But because the former class were just selling software into the existing industry, there was no ability to drive innovation within that. Whereas Uber comes along, owns the supplier relationship, owns the customer relationship, provides a full stack of product offering, and flips the industry on its head. And I've been wondering for a while, is there a comparable here in industry where there is plenty of startups, including those in this room, who are selling to the existing institutions? They're selling grading software, like you mentioned, no more marking. They're selling you know, content generation, everything else. Or there's rocket ship and old school and all of the doing the whole thing from the ground up. I don't know where this question is going, but is there a recommended approach? Is there one track that's better than the other? What's your advice for a founder that's setting up to build something today? Do they sell or do they rebuild?
Yeah, I think that, you know, schools are quite used to buying services. They're also schools that, you know, very much operate in the past. So the kinds of services they are buying are quite old-fashioned in general. And it's typically, you know, imagine the person that's sort of thinking about that coming into a school is somebody who also has a full-time job teaching classes. They're probably lacking a bit in imagination, don't have time to stay on top of the latest tech trends, let alone the latest neuroscience or anything. So their discoverability is quite difficult for schools, and then sort of getting ideas taken up by them. So I think that the ground-up model feels really appealing to me. Like, how can you build with a group of students, or how can you build with a community of teachers, or how can you build with head teachers? Now, finding who those, you know, early adopter head teachers are, or those teachers are, I think is not easy, because it's quite hard to penetrate teacher communities. Teachers have communities around their subject areas, they have sort of training communities, but I think it's difficult to get in. So So I think we need some new spaces in which those groups operate together. And there's a company in London called Century Tech that I'm sure some of you guys know about. And what they're doing is they hire teachers, they hire neuroscientists, they hire developers to work together on things. So that kind of gives them a network into various schools. I think there's kind of this language in education. But if you work too much within the system, I think it can stifle innovation. The education system has a huge amount of inertia. It doesn't want to change. People have been doing the same thing for 30 years. Like everybody sat in school and saw what school was like, and they became a teacher and did things in the same way. Like, how do you then disrupt how that person thinks about what school is?
There's also a sort of a structural credentialism, maybe the right word, where the people who are leading the system are doing so because they gained the credentials along the way from the top universities. They'll turn around and encourage everyone else to say that success is receiving a credential from the top university.
Right.
There's even one, there was two until one of them left, companies in the room today who help companies help individuals optimize themselves towards a particular credential, which is a fantastic service to those individuals. But what do you think about the kind of the longer term view of that? Are they optimizing towards a false goal here?
Mm.
Or how does that impact on the future of education?
Yeah, so the example that jumps to mind there is 42 in Paris. So 42 is this coding university. It's amazing. And it was set up by this guy called Nicolas Sadirac, who for years had been operating sort of on the fringes of French tech education, like running private schools, running online learning programs. And he managed to convince this guy, Xavier Niel, to give him 100 million euros to start a tech school, which would be free at point of entry. And his whole point was that, having worked in universities for 20 years, he absolutely wanted this to be private. He didn't want it to be credentialed by the state or by the system, because he knew that would ruin the whole enterprise. So he's gone like completely the other way. And it's amazing. It's like the most innovative further education institution I've seen. There are no teachers. Software runs all the learning. The kids work. They have this amazing selection process. You don't have to have any qualifications to enter. It's like this big, they call it the swimming pool, la piscine, this big kind of 20-day competition to get in there. And his point is, don't be in the system if you want to do something really good. But then you do need to find the money for it. And part of that's to do with accreditation. So within our current university structures, school structures, the way we measure success is fundamentally flawed. So if you're trying to optimize what schools are doing, working towards that system of like GCSE grades, like helping kids to get better GCSEs, sure, that's good because you're helping them to do better at the things that the system currently values. But ultimately, you're not doing the work of reforming the system, which I think is vitally important. And that's where the bigger story of innovation is. Like, how do we change what education is for, what kids learn? How do we do that kind of disruptive activity? And that does mean, I'm sure, at some point, partnering with governments or making strong arguments towards them. The one possible entry point for our system in the UK is that, you know, because of academisation and free schools, there's been this decentralisation. So schools now have much more autonomy for deciding what they're going to do, what kinds of curriculums they'll run. They still have to do GCSEs and so on, but I think there's a big opportunity there as well for doing things anew.
When you think about different schools like this, different models, say School 42, and compare that to a traditional, very traditional university, one of the top tiers in the UK, how do you think about assessment at parity of grade or ability to assess a person coming out of one or the other? And I know sort of maybe a continuation of this thought is countries and schools within those countries are ranked globally on an annual basis, the basis of the ability of the educational system or the ability of the people coming out of it.
That's right.
And Norway's done well previously, Sweden's done well previously, various countries have risen and fallen at different times. How do we assess the success in the education system of tomorrow if it's not relying upon grade systems that perhaps are misguided? Or benchmarking systems which are perhaps misguided.
Right. Yeah, no, I think that, so in like the highest performing, one of the highest performing systems is Finland, and their kids aren't assessed at all, except by their teachers in classrooms. So teachers are trusted to be the kinds of professionals that can understand like where a kid is at in different aspects of their learning, make judgments about it, and then give the kid the next learning experience that they might need. I went to this one amazing classroom with this guy, Pekka Pajora, who he does a kind of flipped classroom where he gives all the learning materials to the kids at the beginning of the term, gives them all their tests, gives them all their answers, and then sort of coaches them on their various learning abilities, like their perseverance, their ability to cooperate, to imagine, to create. And then at the end of the year, he asks them what grade they should get, and they give them themselves their own grade. And I think that, so in some situations, as long as you, the learner, know what you know, and you're clear about the things that you're good at and not what you like, then you can be your own advocate. And do you need a blanket system to tell us the answer to that question of like what every kid knows? Perhaps we used to. It used to make sense when you're thinking about staffing a massive civil service or, you know, sending kids like into roles around an empire. Like, you want to have a sense of that, and like you have your elite that rise to the top. But I think today we want a system in which, like, many, you know, like a thousand flowers bloom, like many different people get good at different things, and the current system evaluation doesn't allow for that. So on the one hand, is it employers, is it kind of institutions that people are entering into that do that kind of evaluation before people join? Are there third-party, sort of like middle-layer type organisations, like credentialing organisations, micro-credentialing organisations that could have the legitimacy, the kind of trust that a degree currently has, for example, in the world, that could do a much better job of telling a story about what you know? Because, you know, actually those GCSE grades or that degree or those A levels tells you very little about what that person, who that person is, what they can do.
And what you're saying too here, I think, is that there's sort of you are required to align the incentives of the ultimate beneficiary, maybe it's an employer, with that of the education institution. Mm-hmm. Maybe encouraging, in Udemy, I think in the US, Google has got involved and actually drawn up an Android engineering course.
Right.
Is there any broader application of that kind of thing that you've seen around the world, where sort of the end beneficiary, the employer, is actually getting involved in the education system?
Yes, so like a number of the most exciting schools that I saw around the world were set up by groups of local businesses. So there's another one in California called High Tech High. I mean, the same is true of 42, right? Of High Tech High, which is like a school in San Diego, completely project-based. And like each of their classrooms is like a sort of futuristic design lab. There was, this was all happening in one classroom, 15-year-old kids, and they were in these different project groups. One group was experimenting with creating biodegradable seed pods. Another group was scripting a documentary. And another group still were making drones completely from scratch. And then this group was going to go out and they were going to do a 7-day expedition into the California wilderness to make like an aerial survey of like the degradation of plant life, to replenish plant species that they found to be lacking, and then like make a documentary about this that they were going to put on YouTube afterwards. And at the end, they either get a 1 or a 0. Like, what matters is that they did the project and they contributed to it. And I think some of these things, what you have then is like more like a CV. I created this thing. I did this piece of work. I did this project. I know how to use this piece of software. They all like use various different, you know, like kind of CAD software. They all like develop some computer programs. They all do essays, you know, so they have more like a portfolio that they're showing. And that's what the employers in the area would prefer to see, rather than like your grade point average, which is not descriptive. Like, bring the pieces of work to us. There's a school in East London called Elam where the music industry sets the projects for the kids currently, and if the projects are good enough, so like create a viral music video, do a jingle for a radio show, if it's good enough, the company will pay them like they would any contractor. So there's no need for there to be sort of like a grade that you did. Like, you show your viral video or you play your piece of music that you created. So I think like that feels to be very interesting for industry. But then, of course, there are also all of these, you know, General Assembly, Mind Dojo, these different kind of organisations where you can get more formal credentials and show them. And I think those are very important as well. In somewhere like Singapore, they have a whole system where they give money to people to career change. Like, if you want to retrain, then you can get some money from the government in a sort of lifelong learning scheme to learn to code. They have like a very coherent education system in which I think your abilities and outcomes are quite well tracked by the government as well. But yeah, there are different ways of doing it, for sure.
Final talking point from me, I think, and then hope everyone else has been stacking up questions as we go. It's not really a question. I'm trying to set up a conclusion, perhaps. There's a a metaphor you give in the book, which is the Jeffrey West's scale one. Mm-hmm. Cities, or education as cities as opposed to education as companies. Mm. You're going to do a better job of explaining this here, but the core piece is that perhaps the school of the future looks more like an organism or a community of people working towards a collaborative goal, each piece of which can succeed or fail on its own and support the whole.
Exactly.
Is there a...
Yeah.
You know, where do we go from here? Let's just leave it at that. What's the most promising direction you would like to see us take as entrepreneurs in the education technology space?
Yeah, so I mean, our school system it's the whole history of schools has been very hierarchical, and it's been quite a closed system. Like, you know, the people that run it acquire knowledge, they decide what people should know. Kids go into school, they're asked to comply, every kid learns the same stuff, we test it in the same way. And this, I think, is analogous to like an old model of a company. It's top-down, it's hierarchical. But I think about the kind of Korean education system, which is incredibly narrow. Like, what grade you get in your final exam decides a national rank, which gives you your university place, what you can do in a company. And these top-down companies, we all know now, are failing. You know, you need to be more flexible, you need to be more open source, you need to be reaching out into the world. So the question is... And this guy, Jeffrey West, he's a systems theorist. He was an astrophysicist, worked in Los Alamos. He has this whole theory about systems. Like, cities have these amazing efficiencies. As they grow, they become more efficient users of resources. As they grow, you need like fewer gas stations to service more people. They become more creative, so you get like more patents being made per populace as the city gets bigger. So they're kind of these amazing engines of efficiency. So this model of cities are very kind of analogous to organisms. The same thing happens in nature. You have these power laws, like as an organism gets bigger, needs less energy to do the same amount of work. And so, can we make our schools and our school systems more organic? Can they be more like ecosystems? And that requires schools to break down the walls of the school. I think it requires us to be more flexible in things like our school day, like how kids generate the curriculum for themselves, and then how they engage with learning outside of school and how that relates to what you're doing within the school building. You can imagine kids standing up at a building, they will do different things on that day. The teacher helps the groups of kids that need help with a particular topic. Maybe the teacher is creating playlists and for other kids in particular areas, but meanwhile they're engaged in some out of school program where they're doing like a bunch of stuff online. The teacher's then using some of the data that comes from that to make decisions about what kids learn next. Kids themselves are getting that data back. I just think that the tools that we have at our disposal now, our understanding of how brains work, like collective intelligence, these kinds of ideas, I think make us right for creating this education system in the image of organisms rather than sort of factory structures. And I think that's the future of learning.
Awesome place to wind up the formal part. Does anyone have a question they'd like to ask? If you could boast and just speak loudly to the mic, if you're far, then maybe we can repeat it to you.
And comments as well.
Yeah, I'm just going to start with a personal story. My little brother actually tried to get into School 42, and he didn't. So he spent, for people who don't know, like the selection process is not just taking an exam. He spent a whole week there with a sleeping bag, sleeping under his desk, and he didn't come back home for a week, trying to do coding exercises and all of these things. And the promise is that whatever your level, you're going to, it's all about how smart you are, how creative you are, etc. And the truth is that it's not the case, because I love the model. The problem is that there's only one School 42 in all of France, and so lots of people who've been studying software engineering for a couple of years are now coming because you have the brand School 42, which helps you get jobs at Google, etc. afterwards. So my little brother, who I think is very smart and creative, didn't stand a chance in front of all of these people. So lots of the stuff you're saying, which I find absolutely fascinating, relies on creating new models, creating new schools, completely reshaping the way schools work at the moment. What I'm wondering is what can people do right now with the existing models that we can't just completely destroy tomorrow? What can teachers do? What can we do? What can we do today to start making things a little bit better?
Hmm. Yeah, so I think it's true today, and I don't think it's ever going to change, that there is nothing more important in how well a child does at school than the teacher. That is well proven. So, like, you know, if you have a teacher in the like top 10% of teachers versus the bottom 10% of teachers, you can learn like a whole year's more stuff in the year you're in that class than you would otherwise. Like, a teacher is completely instrumental. So my question would be, like, how can we equip teachers or like help them to have time to do more of the things that mean they could be really good in the classroom? So at the moment, teachers have to do like a lot of bureaucratic tasks, they have to do a lot of things that have to do with compliance, they have to do like a bunch of marking, which I don't know if is really valuable use of their time. They have to sit there while kids do their math problems. Like, what tools can we put into the hands of like excellent educators to save them time, to give them opportunity to engage with new ideas? And those kinds of tools I think we can do today. And that, you know, in someone like Rocket Ship, you can already see them in place. In something like No More Marking, you can see that happening. Of course, you have to lobby governments a bit to allow to reduce some of the pressure. But I think that would be my entry point. Like, and then how do you build maybe a grassroots community of teachers that are doing those things, so not have to tackle the structures of the system? And anything that can make a teacher's life easier, like this is like, you know, time-saving things, I think will immediately be adopted by teachers because teachers never have enough time. So maybe that would be my entry point. And you see teachers doing it. Like this teacher in Finland, he was just using Google Drive, like using some basic sort of mobile phone software to like beam in answers for questions that he put up there. So he'd found the bit of tech that was going to help him to make his class more efficient, like, you know, just kind of shared documents that the kids were working on together. Places like Summit Schools in California, which has kind of got Facebook working with them to set up their operating system. Like, operating systems for schools, like, are a really big area of time saving, I think. Yeah, I don't think, like, this stuff about revolutionising the system, that's a generational project. It's not going to happen overnight. And that's why it's good to have institutions like 42 and others to show what could happen. You need a few of these sort of ones at the frontier. But yeah, helping teachers.
Can you talk about the content that is being taught? And in particular, I'm really interested, I've got a four-year-old myself, and I'm thinking about the world that she is going to grow up into. It's going to be very different to the one that I grew up into. And a lot of the jobs we know are not going to exist. And so in a world where machine learning and AI are going to be very important, and in a world where lots and lots of cognitive things that are now important are going to be relatively less important, what still remains in the curriculum that is actually worth teaching?
Right. Yeah, this is a huge question. I mean, I'm also interested in the points of view of people, the kind of neuroscientists in the room. But so first of all, the stuff about the brain that I understand, it's not yet clear to me what the potential implications are of like outsourcing parts of learning sort of or skipping them. So you imagine something like learning to, yeah, I don't know, add or subtract or multiply or calculate or spell. Like, of course, machines can do those things better than we can now. But it seems like if you don't do those things as a learner, if you don't kind of, you know, do some of the boring drilling and mastering of what was kind of called secondary knowledge, learn the techniques of written language, that you don't then ever get to the point where you can think critically or act creatively. So it feels like there'll always be a place for learning the basics. It's a horrible term, but like you've got to master the basics to some level. Like, maybe there'll be other basics, like logical thinking. Like, what are the kind of roots of some of the other kinds of, like, what are the roots of analysis that you might need to do in the future? Those things. However, you've got to do those things without killing, like, what is the most important thing, which is, like, learning to love learning, or, like, falling in love with a subject or the thing that you want to do. So as well as mastering the basics, you need to have time to play and explore and figure out who you are, like, where you find your sort of creative sense of self-expression, like, meaning. So creativity, and like these things roughly fall into like buckets of whatever, thinking, like, am I learning to thinking, am I developing my full cognitive ability, am I mastering the basics are going to give me that kind of automaticity of thought that when I get to the higher level I don't have to like turn to the book or like, you know, struggle with my spellings. Then doing, like, I mean, much more doing in schools. Like, one of the worst things that are happening in the UK right now is that, you know, art subject entries are falling year on year. Like, kids don't no longer have access to art or music or drama, and these things again are vitally important, like design, like all kids should have access to that, I think. So doing is like a really big part of it. And then being, you know, we have this, you know, mental health crisis amongst young people, we live in this world where you have to be very resilient, like things are difficult, so what can we do to support kids to, you know, manage their mental health, to like understand how to be in community? I think these things are going to be really important in the future. And there are individual schools out there doing each of those things like really fantastically well. Like Charles Dickens School in Southwark is doing amazing work on mindfulness, but they work with Yale and the Centre for Emotional Intelligence in this primary school. On the creativity side of things, something like High Tech High. On the thinking side of things, there are incredible schools out there doing that stuff. But it's difficult to deliver all of that really well in an education, certainly. And then on top of that, I think this kind of collective sense, like how do you learn to cooperate and collaborate? So you know how to think, you know how to do stuff, you know how to be cooperating. And then underneath that all, learning to learn. So like how are you going to be able to manage your learning throughout your career? And for me that means finding something that you love, because you're not going to stick at something that you don't like. And then sort of finding the people that will support you through that.
Yeah, just repeating that for the mic in case it was a bit quiet. We're just thinking about the skills that will be required in the future in terms of iterative learning.
Yeah.
As opposed to future proofing those skills.
Yeah, that's right. So let's say, you know, you've got the basics that you need to sort of operate successfully in the world. I think that there's a couple of pieces to this. First of all, I think you need the opportunities for learning to exist. Like, who's going to provide those opportunities for learning lifelong? I think we need to change the culture that sits under our education system. At the moment, it's very much about front loading. Like, I remember getting to the end of my schooling and then university with the realization that I had like never set a goal for myself, never given myself my own success criteria. I had absolutely no idea how to operate in a world where nobody was, you know, giving me the parameters in which to operate. So I think we should break those down before kids get to the end of school, before they get to the end of university. There's cool stuff happening, like Mission U in the US, doing like a sort of one-year pre-university course where you learn like a general set of stuff. The African Leadership University, again, does this cool, like it's entrepreneurship, it's citizenship, creativity, like various kind of, like a modular program where you're learning skills that are more relevant for the world. I think it comes back though to this kind of learning to learn thing. Like, do you know how to set your own goal? Like, figure out what it is you want to learn, to inquire into that, to develop a project yourself. And so there are lots of schools doing things like that with things like project-based learning, which then kind of like leads to more project-based university experience. Like, university sector is like completely ripe for revolution, I think. Everything is focused on this academic model where you get a bit of piece of paper at the end. And the things that you learn that are really important are, of course, the things that you did in your free time. But I think, like, from the education point of view, it's just like an attitudinal and a structural thing. It's kind of projects rather than kind of like end goals. And it's learning to learn and like love what you're doing, rather than learning to, you know, just do what somebody else tells you is important, I hope.
Conscious of time.
I'm wondering what's going on.
What's the answer?
I'll hang out and talk more afterwards.
We're obviously going to hang out and talk more afterwards. You can do more if you want.
We'll just take all three and then we'll try and...
Okay, we're doing three.
Just do three with all of the same time.
Yeah. So just a quick there's a video on YouTube by Sir Ken Robinson where he talks about how schools kill creativity, which I completely connect with because I can validate that growing up in a school system where you have a curriculum that's only geared towards people who are, you know, supposed to be good at maths, English and science, which sadly all three of them I sucked at.
Yeah.
But through that, I found my own talents, which I knew I was good at. Mm-hmm. But had I known, or someone had been there to kind of show me the way as I was going through school, another direction which I could have taken to find my dream and find out what I wanted to do as a career, I would have probably followed that lead a lot earlier. So my question is do you think everybody in society should be given back to the educational system? Mm-hmm. And if so, how?
That's a great question. So, I think that, yeah, they definitely should be. And I think it connects to what you're saying. So one of the, there's a psychologist called Ben Bloom who studied these 120 creative geniuses. How do they become creative? How do they become geniuses? And we all know this 10,000 hours practice thing now, that like you have to really strive at what you're doing, you know, practice it relentlessly and you get good finally. But there's another bit of his research which is less celebrated, and that's all to do with like, at the beginning of their careers in these fields, all of these people had what he calls a romance stage, where they like fell in love with what they were doing. They had an opportunity to like play and experiment and learn about it, fall in love with it, which is why they wanted to do it for the next, you know, however many decades. And I think that's what kids don't get now. We don't provide as a society is opportunities to discover what your thing might be that you want to fall in love with. In school, you just get to see math, science, and English. So what could we do to set up partnerships between the world at large and schools and children so they can explore different fields and find what their passion might be? Like everybody, you know, we all work, we should all be going to school talking about what we do. We should all be, you know, getting work experience, getting how much a pain it is to have those kids with you at different times. Like, it's really worth the investment. This is the stuff that's going to give those kids the opportunities that, like, many of us lacked in our school to find the thing that we're really into. So I think that, and like, you can just, yeah, so that's how we try and solve it. Like, connecting kids to the world at large so that each child has can taste like 20 different things that they might do. There's this guy called Gerd Rouse who runs this thing called Kidsania, which is like a sort of theme park where kids can do different professions. He's a really amazing guy, but he always says kids can't aspire to what they don't know exists. So it's now like them understanding that these kids and see what it means.
I think a very compelling vision of the future where every child fulfills their potential.
I hope.
I don't know why
what's coming to the question. Yeah.
But many people might put to you, well, children are all very different, they're very differentiated. Most children are simply not very smart. Not everyone's a genius with this untapped potential for learning. Would you prefer a world where there's equality of opportunity or one where there's equality of outcome?
I would venture that in a world of true equality of opportunity, there would be equality of outcome. Because we tell a story about equality of opportunity, which is not an equality of opportunity. Like, at every stage of a child's life experience, their background is having an influence on how they're getting on. So there's no bigger factor in determining education outcomes in reality than how much your parents earn. Like, that's the single biggest thing that decides how you're going to do at school. And that begins from, like, day one. Like, the average number of words you hear in a home, like, the number of different, you know, cultural experiences your eyes are open to. And so I think that if you built the right kind of education system and gave everybody true equality of opportunity, you would have a better equality of outcome. In Finland, they invest a lot in helping kids to catch up, so they kind of take a more egalitarian approach. In our system today, we invest in a competition. Like, it's a race to the top. The ones that make it get the best outcomes, but it's the ones who make it also the ones who had the best start at day one. So I think that, yeah, I fudged your question, but I think you can do both.
Yes. Hi. I really, really enjoyed your book.
Thank you.
And it got me thinking quite a bit. My background's sort of worked with ed tech companies for the past few years, and one of the things that I've thoroughly enjoyed doing is going into schools and testing different software products, looking at the impact on teaching and learning. And one memory in particular kind of sticks with me, a school in Kennington I went into versus a private independent school near Colchester, and just looking at those stark differences in terms of the load on the teachers, I suppose. And I think back to doing a lot of reading around education in Finland and how they've reformed the system, and one of the fundamental things is that teaching as a profession is highly respected and regarded. And my personal opinion is that teachers are as important as doctors. You know, they are bringing up the next generation. We talk a lot about, you know, the how we inform young people's careers and assessment and all those sorts of things. But what can we do to change how we view and respect teaching as a profession? How does teacher training change? How do we change that end of the problem?
Yeah, this is my this is the most important question, because there are always going to be teachers. There are always about 500,000 teachers practicing in the UK today. I think we need to tell new stories about what teachers are. So I think we can tell a story that, you know, imagine what we now know about how the brain works, and imagine a teacher being an expert in the latest neuroscience, and imagine us having all these incredible tools that people in this room are creating, these latest tech tools, and a teacher being a really good consumer and knowing about all of those tools that are out there. So you're an expert in the latest tech as well. You continue to be a deep expert in your subject area. You also understand, like, the lessons of group psychology and how to build teams. You're a great coach. And that's going to take time to master. You can imagine then a 7-year sort of practical training experience for every teacher. And I think it needs to be more practical. At the moment, it's like too knowledge focused. And you're training up and you become expert in one of those areas potentially at the end. Like, you just give it the prestige that a career like being a doctor has already. We're not about to find more money for teachers, unfortunately, in this country. We might be able to generate some extra time for them if we can outsource parts of their job to smart tech. But I think it's that. It's telling a new story. It's also telling the story that, basically, I say this frequently, that we live in a world in which all of our resources are running out. We have exhausted our planet. The only unlimited resource that exists is human imagination and intelligence. It's the most important work that we have to cultivate that, and that is what teachers do. So we need to tell new stories of that nature, and that's what I'm going to make it my work to do in the future, to try and tell an inspiring story about what teachers are and do and can be. But it's hard.
Yeah. Brilliant.
Well, we'll wrap it there for the formalities anyway. We have the space until midnight. There is no rush to leave. You can hang out, get another drink at the bar. Thank you very much for coming along.
Thank you.
Thank all of you for coming along. It's been fun. We do these every now and again. Keep an eye on your emails for when another one may be coming up. And a final ask from me would be, if you've enjoyed yourself and if you have talented friends who you think you'd back their next venture, or you'd join it, or you'd tell your mum about it, feel free to forward them something about On Deck and introduce them into the community, because we've got a lot of work to do here as well. Thank you.
Thanks, guys. Thank you.
And dessert's on its way in now as well. We'll have the girls.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoy the EdTech podcast and would like to share your message with our listeners of senior leaders and educators, change makers and policy people, then we're looking for quality new partners to advertise with us. Get in touch at theedtechpodcast@gmail.com. What else? I'm taking the popular online Coursera MOOC, Learning How to Learn. Next year, I want to do as much learning as possible. I'd love to hear your own learning stories. What courses have you taken? Books have you read, and learning have you done recently which you would highly recommend to others? Share with us and we will share with all the listeners around the world. That's all for now. See you next time. Bye bye.